gems are found in Renaissance art, on ancient coins, and etched on cave walls. They're even reported in the Bible. But more surprising is when UFOs are seen the most, in times of war. Through centuries, thousands of UFO sightings have been made by high-ranking officials, military pilots, and ordinary soldiers. Often, these fantastic appearances occur at the height of great battles. From World War I to D-Day to Korea, Vietnam, and beyond, military investigators are baffled. Why do UFO sightings spike so drastically during wartime? Could it be mistaken aircraft, or is someone or something looking in on us? In UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know, Mac Maloney chronicles centuries of these incredible sightings and tries to solve the puzzle of why so many UFOs are seen while humanity is at war. Read about the scare ships, the ghost planes, and the ghost rockets, alien giants in the jungles of Vietnam, UFOs controlling our ICBM bases, dogfights with flying saucers during the Gulf War, and more. 300 pages of unbelievable stories, along with many startling photographs. That's UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know, by Mac Maloney. On sale at your local bookstore or on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Lee.
And this is Michelle.
And this is Scott from The Dead Zone, Sundays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard.
Your source for everything paranormal. Para X.
What happens to a ghost when their home is torn down? No one thinks of the disembodied when they rip down old buildings, dig up cemeteries, and build clean, unhauntable condos. Every year, hundreds of spirits are driven out of their own haunts by the careless living to exist alone with no one to scare. At Para X Radio, our hosts feel the plight of these evicted disembodied, and we're reaching out to you to please open your heart to one of these lost souls, such as the ghost soldier of the General Wayne Inn or the abandoned spirit cat of Benjamin Rush. So please, please let a little spooky into your life. Won't you open your house to a ghost without a home?
Para X.
Rat! Rat! Where are you going?
I'm going back to the paranormal view, back where I belong.
Please, please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rat! Rat, don't run to them! They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rat! 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 Rat, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear...
Line!
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
That's The Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
But remember, we'll always see you in the shadows.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Welcome to another Monday night here on the Shadows Radio. I'm Rebecca.
I'm Bill.
And we are excited.
Yeah. Yeah, we're always excited.
We are exciting, at least.
Yes, we are an exciting pair for pleasure.
What?
Or something.
Or something.
Or something.
As Karen in the chat room said, I didn't know you would be here today. I know it's a surprise. Every week it's a surprise to me too.
Yes.
Especially when it comes like 7:30 and I'm like, oh, expletive.
Yeah, right. Insert expletive here.
Well, and then I had like this whole, okay, so I did all the research for tonight's show. You know, I had watched a bunch of documentaries. I had video. I had all this stuff and I saved it. Mm-hmm. And then I went to bed. And when I woke up, it was not saved anymore.
Oh.
So I had to rewrite everything. Thankfully, I had most of my sources still like on the computer. Like I hadn't shut any windows.
Right.
So luckily I didn't have to, you know, redo everything, but.
Well, I just found out about it like an hour ago, so I'm good.
Good job.
Right on top of things I am.
Well, way to read the notes.
There are notes? Oh, yeah. No, I have them open, but, you know. Anyway, happy Monday.
Happy Monday. And it's not snowing, and we're not under another 6 inches of snow. Cause
not yet. Yeah.
Well, they said it was like this weekend we're supposed to get a bunch of snow. And then they were like, nope, never mind. We're just kidding.
And oh, I got 6 here.
You did?
Oh, yeah. I was plowing Sunday.
Oh, we got nothing.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Wow.
I was all disappointed, too, because I had canceled what I had planned to do on Sunday. Like, oh, we're not going to go anywhere. This is dumb. And then I was like, oh, never mind.
Yep. Yeah. I was plowing snow and shoveling snow and all that good stuff.
Oh, that's right. You live out in the sticks.
Yep, I'm out here.
In the boonies.
Why is my web page reloading? I don't like when I reload web pages.
What did you do?
I wouldn't even know what I do. So
don't touch the buttons.
It is Monday, February 8th, and it's National Boy Scouts Day, which I'm happy to say my son, who is a Boy Scout.
Happy Boy Scout Day.
National Kite Flying Day. Yeah, that'll happen. Maybe
not today.
Warmer climates.
Yeah, so why wouldn't they have picked a day that would be more conducive to actually flying a kite in most
you would think
climates?
National Football Hangover Day.
That might be true.
And for our friends in Iowa, it is your day, National Happy Iowa Day. And for good note and good measure, tomorrow is Pizza Day. So it is National Pizza Day tomorrow, and I had to add that one.
Snacks.
Yep.
So I would like to point out that there are more people in my hometown than there are in the entire state of Iowa.
That's true.
However, you enjoy your day there, Iowa.
What's your favorite pizza, Sicilian or Neapolitan or deep dish? Or
no, see, I've recently gotten into like the really like wafer cracker thin.
Oh.
And I don't know. I mean, like I like regular pizza. That's fine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I do like Sicilian pizza. That's like my, you know, but it's so bad for you. So, like, I've kind of guilted myself away from eating it.
Okay.
So, like, if I do pick, I like that, like, wafer-thin cracker. I'm not a big fan of cheese either.
Oh, I love
to be honest. So, like, a little bit of sauce, a little bit of cheese, and then all the toppings stuck up in there.
Kara's like, I cannot know you.
Yeah, well, you don't like the Steelers, so. She's a self-hating Pittsburgher. Really?
And she's from Pittsburgh. Yep. Anyway.
All right.
So there are your days and a couple days in ahead in advance. And, you know, here we are again. Bill, tell Rebecca. And, oh, here we go. Are you not talking again?
I don't know why I'm not being whatever. I don't know. I did something else wrong, apparently.
Oh, my goodness. I am not playing mom and dad. Okay. Sorry.
What if you play grandma and papa?
Something like that.
Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about a very famous haunting. And by famous, I mean it was one of the Ed and Lorraine Warren cases. So we're going to pick it apart a little bit. I did try to get a little bit of both sides of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about what's colloquially known as the Haunting in Connecticut, or the Snedeker family.
The what?
Snedeker.
Snedeker, okay.
Snedeker.
Just reading it wrong.
Yes,
yeah, I've seen a couple of documentaries on this myself, so nothing that really stuck in my head, but I will learn tonight from you, Rebecca.
Yeah, and I actually I got a chance to meet Carmen previously Carmen Snecker, now Carmen Reed, at Phenomenology a couple of years ago. And she's very nice, very sincere. And the one thing I want to say for her, with all of the kind of stuff that gets thrown at you just for being a Warren case, because, I mean, just by, you know, pure, you know, association with them, everyone throws all this like, oh, it's a fraud, it's a fake, it's a whatever at you. She has always stuck to her story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, all right.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I mean, so.
So, all right. So the story takes place in Southington, Connecticut, which I'm probably saying wrong because apparently I've learned that in New England, town names are not actually what they look like. Because we actually play a game driving through Massachusetts going, I make a guess, and then my husband tells me I'm really, really wrong.
Yeah, so, and being from Boston, so yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to call it Southington. I'm probably wrong, but you can bear with me on that one.
Okay.
So the Snedeker family is Alan and Carmen and their three sons, Philip, Bradley, AJ, and a daughter, Jennifer. And then eventually nieces Kim and Tammy Alvis will come into the story, but not yet. So the family was living in upstate New York until oldest son Philip turned 13 when he's diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. Mm-hmm. The closest facility for treatment was UConn in Hartford, Connecticut. So the family began making 300-mile road trips 5 times a week for Philip's treatment. The radiation treatment burned his skin from the inside, and Carmen was afraid that the trips would kill her son as fast as the cancer. So I could see how that would be.
Terrible.
Yeah, that's pretty much a full-time job just getting your kid back and forth to treatment, let alone anything else that you're doing with your life.
Right.
So the family decides they're going to move closer to the treatment center. And on June 30th, 1986, they moved from upstate New York to 208 Meridian Avenue in Southington, Connecticut, to be near the hospital for their son's cobalt treatment and ongoing treatment for Hodgkin's lymphoma. They moved into a simple white duplex rental. Having fallen on hard financial times due to the medical issues, they jumped at a chance to rent what appeared to be the perfect house. It was large enough for their family, which included their three children and a cousin, and their rent was in the affordable price range.
Right. It's a beautiful house.
It really is when you look at it. Now, it is a duplex. It's not a, it's, you know, there's two houses in there. If you look at the picture on the Shadows Radio Facebook page, we posted a picture of the house. It is a duplex in that, you know, there's a family upstairs and a family downstairs. But still, even with all that, having enough room for three kids plus some relatives that come to stay.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty big space. So.
Yeah.
All right. So the home had previously been the funeral home called the Hallen Funeral Home for decades before it was converted to a private home in the early 1980s. The Sneckers claim that no one told them that the house was previously a funeral home. Carmen
I don't think it would have mattered.
Yeah, right. So Carmen claims that she had never entered the basement during a pre-rental walkthrough because renovation materials were blocking the stairwell. However, this claim is disputed by the landlord, who claimed that they fully explained the basement to the family. However, Carmen herself then claimed in an episode of Paranormal Witness that she rented the property sight unseen. So, not sure which version of that you want to go by. However, so she says that either way, whether she rented it sight unseen or whether she just didn't see the basement, she claims she was never in the basement. And then the landlord's like, no, we totally told her. Like, it's not a secret.
Right.
Okay. So when they moved in, Al noted that over every door was a crucifix. And in the basement, the family found various mortuary equipment, including a hoisting apparatus for coffins, a medical gurney, blood drains, and toe tags. They also found a small cemetery out back of the property and a drawer full of corpse photos and personal items of deceased.
I have a hard time believing that. Like, if you're going to rent a house, you're going to leave all that stuff out. Or, you know, you're going to keep it in there.
Yeah, it's a little weird as to why. I mean, someone was living there before them.
Yeah.
So,
but anyway, I guess that's how the story goes. But I'm just thinking, like, really, when you move into a rental property and they have everything set up downstairs still?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, so Carmen claims that she blocked off the embalming room as best she could, as she did not want Philip reminded constantly of his mortality. She also asked to move, but Al reminded her they didn't have much financial choice. They had to stay there. And he left her and the kids in the house and returned to New York to go back to work. So, I mean, according to her, she kind of felt wompy about it. But, you know.
Right, not much she can do about it.
Yeah, but from the start, she claims she felt wonky about it, but, you know, she wasn't allowed to go anywhere.
You like that word.
What, wonky?
Wonky.
It's just so descriptive. There's so many things that can be wonky. Yes.
Okay, I was just, you know, don't mean to interrupt the story. Just
don't make me come wonky you.
That's right. Anyway.
Well, I made me lose my spot. All right, so Philip eventually moves down to the basement with his brother Brad. Since the upstairs rooms were smaller, it was the only room that could accommodate both teens. It was also near a bathroom for his constant nausea, and the two brothers slept in what was the casket display room down the hall from the former embalming room that they found. The first night in the house, Philip claims he was awakened by someone saying his name. He went to find his mother, who was on the phone at the time, who assured him that the sound must have traveled in the very still house. Philip then asked at that point to leave the house. Obviously, that was not an option.
Now, Philip's he's the oldest
of all the kids. He's 13 at this time.
Okay.
So in this story, he goes from 13 to 15. So he's not, 14 to 16, excuse me.
Okay.
He was diagnosed at 13 and then moves on. So not long after, Carmen says she began experiencing strange phenomena. The first thing Carmen stated reporting was that items were disappearing. The crucifix in what had been the morgue disappeared, but the nail was still attached and undisturbed on the wall. They say, ooh.
Yeah, ooh.
You're used to stealing your crosses that weren't even yours to begin with. In another interview on CNN, Carmen says that the real haunting started from the very first night they moved into the house. She said Philip would play cruel jokes on his family and not remember doing it. That's why they sent Philip to stay with relatives for a little while. See, now this part bothered me. You moved to Connecticut to be closer to the kids' hospital, and then when the kids started weirding you out, you shipped them off to relatives.
Right.
That doesn't make no sense.
No, it doesn't.
But that's what they claim.
That's not how the movie went. But
yeah. So shortly after the boys, Philip, Brad, and AJ were exploring.
Sorry.
What? You all right?
I didn't say no.
Oh, yeah, I thought you were laughing. Maybe it was a ghost.
No.
So the boys, Philip, Brad, and AJ were exploring an area of the basement and were under some counters when AJ put his hand on the floor and felt something sticky. They claimed to see the dark stain on the floor. They reported being spooked and that they ran to find their mom while white as sheets. They told her that the walls were bleeding. So Carmen assured them it was probably just paint.
Yeah.
Okie dokie.
Okie dokie.
Then her children, mainly Philip, reported seeing strange people in the house as well as hearing voices, and they started noticing cold spots around the house. All pretty typical haunting stuff at this point. You know, bleeding walls, voices, missing crosses. Pretty standard.
Yeah.
Demonic level haunting here.
Need the white sheet over the gorilla.
Yes. Over a gorilla. What'd you say?
Not at all.
Did you say over a gorilla?
Oh, a girl in a white dress. Not a gorilla in a dress. No.
You legit just said put a white sheet over the gorilla.
There's a white gorilla in a dress. And I lost my beer. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, you can see what goes on in our paranormal investigations. Yeah.
You say, what are you investigating?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
So. One night, Philip and Brad saw four figures standing in the corner near their toy robot. The toy started going crazy. The four figures turned as one and looked at the boys, where they ran off to find Carmen, who checked the basement and then went to call the cops. When she entered the kitchen, she discovered the crucifix over the door to the kitchen was gone. The next day, Carmen told Philip that he was not to tell his younger siblings ghost stories anymore, and was starting to freak her out.
Right.
I do like that the crucifix are kind of like a countdown. You started with 10. Now you're down to 2.
They're all going missing.
Yeah.
Screwed.
What? What'd you say?
I said you're all screwed.
Oh.
Yeah.
You're breaking up a little bit. So it was a little hard to hear. I was like, wait, what?
Okay. Must be a delay or something.
Something. All right. So,
sorry.
All right. So one day Brad comes home from school to find Philip moving his bed into the embalming room. Philip said that he had, quote, made a deal. He was becoming more withdrawn and rarely was smiling. So I'd be kind of freaked out if my brother wanted to sleep in the embalming room. I don't know about you.
Yeah, definitely.
It's kind of freaky.
As you're reading, I just remember the story of this on one of, I don't know, paranormal shows or something. I'm kind of walking my brain through it. So I'm actually picturing this because I remember it. You know what I mean?
They were on Paranormal Witness.
Was it? Is that what that was?
It was on Sci-Fi. Paranormal Witness Season 2, Episode 7. Because I had to watch that for part of this, too. So one day, Carmen was mopping the kitchen floor and said that the mop water changed completely to blood. The lights would flicker on and off even when they took out the light bulbs. And that the dishes used to put themselves away. Now wait.
Yeah.
If my dishes started putting themselves away, I would leave out treats for the ghost. Be like, dude, you're in. Go.
And the lights flicker on and off even without light bulbs.
Apparently. Do they mean that the bulbs themselves were flickering even like in the trash can? Or were the light fixtures flickering with no bulbs in them?
Ooh.
This is a question that he's answered.
Yes. Anybody in the chat room, go ahead. We need answers.
Yeah. It's important information. However, the fact that you said the dishes put themselves away.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to have that one.
I know. Like, why would you? Yeah, sorry. But I can't even get, the humans around here to put dishes away, let alone deceased humans.
I heard that.
Or laundry. If you want to put some laundry away, ghosts, I got a pile for you.
I need one to fold a fitted sheet. Then I'll be impressed.
Yeah. Oh. That would be awesome. Or to make the bed. That's my other thing. I hate making the bed. I despise it. So any ghosts would like those open positions, let me know.
Go.
All right. Brad also claimed that once, while the boys were playing in the basement, he was thrown on the gurney and spun around wildly and uncontrolled. I feel like that was probably one of his brothers, but apparently that happened. The second summer in the house, now they've been in the house now for at least one summer, so at least a year. Cousins Kim and Tammy arrived to visit. A withdrawn Philip showed no enthusiasm at his cousins being there. Philip had begun keeping a journal, and Brad says that once he tried to bother him about it, but Philip just sat there and stared at his brother with a look that sent chills up his spine. Well, I mean, he could be a moody teenager at this point.
Yeah, I mean, as I remember, he was slowly changing.
Yeah, and that's kind of what they're trying to say. Like, he started out as
taken over by a dark force or something.
Yeah, he started to get very dark.
Yeah.
And that's part of what this journal was, is that one day Tammy was helping tidy up Philip's room when she found the journal. She didn't want to invade his privacy, but she was worried, so she gave it to Carmen. And the pages were dark, full of notes about death, murder, killing, pretty much all the things that you don't even want, like necrophilia, all kinds of stuff, poems about, murdering your family and everything.
Right.
Not so good stuff there. But they said it's totally out of character for him. And even Carmen began to wonder if the words were actually Philip's. Her oldest son was dyslexic, and she spent years trying to get him to properly write his alphabet. And here were complex words perfectly written and spelled correctly. When she asked her son, Philip replied that, quote, the man helped her write. Or helped him write, excuse me.
Oh, wow.
So... it's kind of a weird thing where it's like, is it like a traditional, emo teenager situation where he's just, getting moody because he's a teenager plus he's going through all this stuff? Because remember at this time he's going through cancer treatments 5 times a week.
Yeah. And he's way not having a normal teenager life.
Exactly. So, I mean, is it possible that that's what's going on here, is that he's having a, having a moment?
A regressive episode?
something. Like yeah, there's a lot that could be going on here.
Right.
So.
But.
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, but as your story goes, I mean, it could be many different things, but, you know, as far as paranormal, that's what the story, you know.
So they were describing his personality was changing. He was becoming more aggressive. Like we said, any argument between Philip and Brad would escalate into a fist fight. Whenever Tammy would intervene, Philip walked into a room and tore it apart. When she tried to stop him, he threw her across the room as if she were like a rag doll. So, I mean, he was not a chill, mellow kid at this point, based on, you know, kind of what they were saying.
Right, right.
And then kind of starts the real deep, heavy stuff. And I just want to say a real quick trigger warning. If you're not familiar with this story, there is some rape and situations happening that are about to happen. So just a fair warning.
Right.
That's something that bothers you. Probably should go do something else now. So one night Tammy was asleep and felt something begin pulling the covers off her bed. When she went down the hall to try and tell Carmen about it, she felt someone tugging on her bra strap. Carmen, however, believed it was Philip playing a mean prank on them, not a ghost. And so that kind of is a theme you'll hear a lot in the story, is that Carmen told him it was Philip. Carmen told him it was Philip, not a ghost.
Oh, okay.
So that night at dinner, Carmen, which should actually be the next night at dinner. Sorry. Then the next night at dinner, Carmen does her best to pretend everything's fine. She made his favorite dinner, but the men in white don't even knock. They just walked right into the house, picked up Philip and carried him out. They put him in a straitjacket. And as they put him in a straitjacket, Philip told her, meaning Carmen, that as soon as he was gone, the spirits were going to start coming after her. Carmen did not want to believe that her son would be gone. Want to believe that her son would be schizophrenic for the rest of his life. However, the doctors did believe that that's what was kind of causing his mood shifts and his changes in personality. She went and sat on the stairs to Philip's room, daring, quote, the man to come play with her. She said she sat there for hours and nothing ever appeared. He was committed and taken in for evaluation, where he was pronounced schizophrenic. He was removed from the house for the protection of other children. And he'd be out of the house for 45 days. However, while he's gone, the activity didn't stop.
Okay.
So, I mean, I guess if it was him really doing the things that, you know, they were trying to pass on him, it would have stopped, I guess, when he left, right?
Yeah, you would think. Yeah.
So, meanwhile, he said he gets committed while he's away. Supposedly, he's getting better. Supposedly, while he's at the hospital, he's getting better. He's becoming back to his normal self.
Okay.
And then when he comes back to the house, things kind of go a little wonky again. Kat asked who authorized him being taken away. I think I kind of glazed over that part. Sorry. The mother called his doctor, and his doctor and the mother had him committed for possible schizophrenia and then eventual schizophrenic diagnosis.
Yeah, because the last thing they're thinking of is this house is haunted so bad that it's, you know, affecting his mood, you know.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure your doctor is not going to go there. Like, that's usually their first thought. Their first thought is, oh, something mental is going on.
Yep.
So, all right, we're going to take a break here at this point before some of the dark and heavy stuff happens. But if you want to hang tight, we're listening to The Shadows Radio on the Para-X Radio Network.
sourire et la bouffe.
Façon de merde. C'est toi.
And the paranormal.
Your source for everything paranormal. Para S.
Hey there. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a great new radio show on Para X. Two hosts, 1 hour, and too much fun. Stephanie and Heidi not only talk about the latest goings-on in the supernatural worlds, they live it. They want to hear from you. They want to help you understand and guide you. And they want you to tune in. So, grab a friend or come alone to gather around that metaphysical table with Heidi and Stephanie. If you're interested in the worlds of the unseen, tune in to The Gathering Radio Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Para X Radio.
Your source for everything paranormal. Para X.
Welcome back to the Shadows Radio here on the Para-X Radio Network. I'm still Rebecca.
I'm still Bill.
Are you sure?
Okay. You're like, I'm still Rebecca. I'm like, I gotta go fast.
Talk about something, man.
Anyway.
So we're talking about the haunting in Connecticut.
We are talking about something.
Now you're talking over me, man. What are you doing?
I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
I'm kidding. So we're talking about the haunting in Connecticut, the Snedeker family out in Southampton, Connecticut.
Sling what? Oh, Snedeker. Okay.
Carmen
still having
Reed,
a hard time with that word.
Because that's what she goes by now. So before we kind of took our break, we talked about some of the kind of the ramp up of stuff that was going on. You know, it started out with the boys seeing some stuff in the basement, hearing some voices, you know, nothing super over the top. Until they find,
super,
you know, the oldest son, Philip, kind of starting to go a little dark and morbid in his personality.
Right.
And they he starts kind of telling his mom that because he's not there, now the spirits are going to go after her.
Right.
So he was committed, like I said, his mother and his doctor committed him for schizophrenia. He's taken out of the house. And so later, just after he was taken out of the house, Carmen was taking a shower, and she claims that the shower curtain enveloped her, tightening around her face and slowly smothering her. She said no matter what she did, she couldn't push it away, but she was able to call for Tammy, who ripped a hole in the curtain so she was able to breathe and eventually free herself.
I like to do that too. Anyway.
Well, I try to think about my shower curtain, and it's like, I don't know if you'd be able to bust a hole through that.
Those
things are thick.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like, if it has a liner, that's even worse. Like, oh, that'd be hard. That'd be terrifying.
That'd be scary.
Although, to be fair, every time I climb in the shower curtain sticks to my butt anyway.
You know, really?
What?
Aren't shower curtains like the choice by serial killers, like the kill people one?
Are they really?
Like, well, you just wrap them up as a shower curtain, throw them outside.
Oh. I guess.
Not that I know anything about that.
I have not made a study of serial killer body disposal, but I can probably ask, the Dark Sun Rising team. They probably know.
There's a whole show on that. It's got to be.
I'm sure there is.
Am I saying it correctly? Disposal of bodies by serial killers.
Dispose all.
Anyway.
So
he's locked up.
Yeah, so he's locked up now. His mom's getting strangled in the shower,
mm-hmm.
which is, in and of itself terrifying. But later that night, Tammy awakes to the covers being ripped violently off of her bed. Now, Tammy is the cousin.
Okay.
She jumps up and runs for her aunt's room. Carmen grabbed a Bible and noticed that the crucifix above her bedroom door, which is the last one in the house that hadn't yet vanished.
It's gone.
Again, like I said, the crucifixes were the countdown to drama, man. Let me tell you.
Right.
Was now missing. The women climbed into Tammy's bed and began reading out loud from the Bible. Tammy immediately felt something approaching and then felt a hand groping her body under her clothes. Carmen said she could see the bones of the hand and wrist through her clothes, her being Tammy. They then ran to the dining room, but it seemed to follow them. The rosary around Tammy's neck broke as if it was pulled and then scattered to the floor.
Wow.
So that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Pretty intense. I don't know about you, but I'm not feeling a ghost groping anytime.
No, I won't go there.
Just no.
No, I won't. But I always had that the hard time. Okay. Unfortunately, I get into the paranormal shows like many of us do.
Mm-hmm.
But when they talk about demonic entities having the ability to remove crosses or crucifix and things like that, it's like they're supposed to be holy, blessed material. It's like, how can they take that if that's what it represents? You know?
Well, I think part of it too is that, you know, they might necessarily, so they're not supposed to be able to touch blessed material, but not all crucifixes are technically blessed.
No, that's
true. Just because it's the shape of a cross doesn't necessarily mean that it's been blessed. I mean,
right.
I mean, when I buy a rosary, I have to take it to my priest and have him, you know, do a prayer over it. That's how it becomes a sacred object. So, I mean, you could be talking about something like that where it's, you know, it just has to be, it hasn't been, I guess, you know, officially sanctioned. I don't know. I don't know where these objects came from. They were there in the house when they moved in. So, I don't know.
Right. Okay.
But again, you're right. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of one of those things. Now, is it also one of those things where, like, the demon had a stick and was just knocking it off the wall? Not necessarily grabbing it. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was, you know, grabbing it off the wall.
But they're gone. It's not like they're falling. They're totally gone. Disappeared.
True. Yes.
Yeah. So. Anyway.
Although I like the image of a little demon running from room to room with a big stick, like, boop. Just running next room. Boop. Okay. Here we go. I got it. That's terrible. I'm sorry. So where was I? All right. So Tammy's rosary breaks. She scatters to the floor. So in an interview with Carmen in the Huffington Post, she says that she tells the same story of the hand going up her knee. Certainly this time, and this is the only time I found this incident. She adds, quote, it laughed a hideous laugh when above her shirt, it went up her shirt and out the window. That's the only time I ever heard the laugh comment before. Usually it was, oh, I saw the bones going up her body, and then we screamed and ran. That was the only time when she was talking to the Huffington Post is when she said, you know, they did a hideous laugh.
Yeah, I never heard that.
At one point, Philip told police and doctors at the hospital that he would fondle his cousins in his sleep, guided by the man. However, just keep in mind that during this incident, he was not home.
This is right
after he was committed, so... what they were seeing or feeling, I don't know. So other things that were reported, and I didn't go into a lot of detail on the next little piece just because it grosses me out, but was that repeated and brutal rape of both Carmen and her niece Tammy, as well as acts of sodomy performed on her husband when he was actually in the house, both by unseen entities. The scent of rotting flesh and decay were reported throughout the house. And then Carmen herself was frightened of apparitions that she saw. Quote, they were incredibly powerful. One of them was very thin with high cheekbones and long black hair and pitch black eyes. And another had white hair and eyes and was wearing a pinstripe tuxedo and his feet were constantly in motion. End quote. So, very specific. However, what she claims to have seen is also what Philip claims to have seen. So whether she got the description from him and just rolled with it, or whether they both saw the same thing is, you know, a little bit in question.
Right.
So, all that going on, enter the Warrens. See, this couldn't be happening in Connecticut without the Warrens getting involved. It's just a requirement. So Ed and Lorraine Warren, the Connecticut demonologist, who, if you're not familiar, are infamous for their involvement in the Amityville Horror case and also the Enfield Poltergeist case, and among many others.
Right.
So they come to investigate the house. Along with John Zaffis, who's their nephew, and a few investigators, they moved into the house for several weeks until they'd experienced everything the Stedeckers claim. Now, I want to know, if they're claiming sodomy and rape, which investigator got unfortunately tasked with that one? Because that's not cool.
No.
So during their time in the house, they claim to have seen firsthand the damage the, quote, demons in the house could inflict, with many members being slapped, beaten, pushed, or slammed to the floor. Now, one of the weird things about this, and I tried to find it, was that John Zaffis did an interview recently where someone had asked him about this case specifically and said, you know, how come none of the evidence has ever been turned up?
Okay.
How come we've never seen video? Did you guys claim to have videos? This is the, you know, the mid 80s. There's videotape.
Right.
You know, you claim to have audio tapes and videos of all this stuff. Why hasn't it ever been released? Or at least bits and pieces, part of a documentary, something.
Mm-hmm.
And John claimed, and I say this with all due respect because I like John as a person, but he said,
right,
the production company owns all of our footage from that night.
Oh,
or from those nights. And that kind of sat weird with me going, well, what production company? What are you talking about? And like, what?
Yeah, I haven't.
It was just a weird thing to say, like, even if you could have described it to me, hey, there's a video of so-and-so being pushed down the stairs, or hey, there's an audio clip of this voice or that voice or something, but it's all kind of like, oh, this mysterious footage that supposedly exists is in the hands of a production company, which is just, like I said, it was just a weird way to phrase it and say it. I don't know. To me, it just seemed odd the way it was said.
Sure.
So let's see.
Okay.
So supposedly while they're there, all this kind of stuff is happening to them. They're experiencing everything that the Snedeckers family had claimed. So investigation into the history of the house supposedly revealed that one of the undertakers at the funeral home was found guilty of necrophilia, which infused the house with deep evil. It got to the point that the Warrens deemed it necessary to do a full-scale exorcism of the property, after which the house was judged clean by the Warrens. One of the family members, Al, the father's sister, actually did an interview at one point where she said that the family wasn't allowed near the house while these investigations were happening. And they also were not allowed anywhere near the house during the exorcism either. So they don't really know what happened during that time period other than what they were told.
Huh.
Which, again, seems a little odd. If someone's in my house doing an exorcism, I would want to know.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's just me. It's just me, but, you know.
Yeah, not just be told it's clear.
Yeah. Hey, welcome back from your 2 weeks of wherever you were. We're good.
Yeah.
Have fun. Okay. So, according to John Zaffis, and this is a quote, I worked on the case for 9.5 weeks and witnessed and experienced things I've never experienced. I was there. I know what transpired, and so does everyone else in the house at the time. I was in the kitchen documenting, and there was a foul smell. So I got up, looked at the top of the stairs, and saw a transparent, murky color that sounded like a bunch of plastic bags. I later learned it was what we called the fluttering of the wings, which is a low-level demonic sound. End quote. So, I mean, he does have actual, like, this is what I saw, this is what I heard kind of things, quotes out there, you know?
Right.
Everyone in the chat room is now ranting on me for bad-mouthing John Zaffis. I'm not bad-mouthing John Zaffis.
No.
I like John Zaffis. I've met him several times. He's a very nice man.
Yeah, I would love to interview him.
It was just an odd way to phrase the answer to a question, where's the evidence that you guys have? It was just a weird way to phrase that. And it could have been anybody who said that, and it would have been a weird way to phrase it.
Right.
Okay, so eventually other facts emerge, including, like I said, the troubled nature of the oldest son, who besides having a drug habit, was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and then goes on to admit some of the vileness himself. The Snedeckers moved out of the house after 2 years, and no reports of supernatural activity have ever been reported from any subsequent owners. Now, of course, the Warrens claim, oh, it's because we cleared the house. That's why nobody else has had any problems. But then other people come along and say, oh no, it's because there never was any problems to begin with. So, from the other side of the coin, there's a few things that people have noted that make the story a little, you know, different. So Carmen Reed, also Carmen Sedeker, claimed that she was, quote, special and could feel things when they were about to happen. However, during an interview when she was asked why they stayed in the house so long, she claimed, quote, well, it was the kids being tormented. I was unaware of it, end quote. So how are you going to pretend to, or not pretend, sorry, how are you going to declare to be psychic and or special and can feel when things are about to happen, however these things are tormenting your kids and you have no idea?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, seems a little off, that comment.
Yeah, there's too many different angles here that are...
Yeah, so either explained. You're not special and you just, like, said you were, you know, sensitive because you wanted to feel in with the crowd, or you actually weren't, and whatever. So,
right.
Al's sister, Nancy Boucher, I'm not sure how you pronounce exactly her last name, claimed to have lived in the house for a bit with her kids when they were small and she was homeless. She said that she stayed there for a few months but moved out before any of the heavy stuff started happening. I saw the interview with her. It wasn't very long. It wasn't very in-depth. However, she's the one that claimed that no one was allowed near the house during the exorcism or the investigation. So, interesting, though, that she lived in the house, and that's never mentioned in any version of the story that I've ever seen. That
right.
She and her kids lived there at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting. And investigator Joe Nickel reports in the May-June issue of Skeptical Inquirer magazine that the Snedeker's landlady found the whole story ridiculous. She notes that nobody before or since has experienced anything unusual in the house, and that the Snedeker family stayed in the house for more than 2 years before deciding to leave. So, I mean, you can take this as the grain of salt that you want to, however big a grain of salt you want to take it with. They claim that, you know, the stuff didn't really start building up until 1 year into the process, you know? So I can see how they lived there for a little while before stuff started kind of ramping up.
Right.
And then also at times it takes you a little while to, like, okay, there's a lot going on. Let me figure out maybe it's the house. Like, it's probably not the first thing you're going to go with, at least not in my head. So it might've taken them that much time to figure out exactly what was going on.
I would think. Yeah. Because your mind is not there when you have a child with cancer that's dying, you know, and then you're putting him in an asylum because you think he's got schizophrenia because you're not thinking out, I guess you want to say, in quotes, outside the box, you know what I mean?
Exactly. That's it. Yeah, so it doesn't say how long after the exorcism that they actually moved out. I couldn't find a date for when they actually moved out versus when the Warrens did their exorcism.
Right.
So I don't know how long after that point they stayed. So that would, for me, would be the more interesting value rather than that they were there for 2 years.
Right.
Because it's not like they walked in the door and the demon just kind of waved at them like, hey, welcome home. Have some brownies. Like, you know, it's not like that. It was, you know, kind of, there was a slow build up. Like there always is in these stories. It's always, you know, it starts with a little thing and then works its way up. So, but one thing that was interesting to me is that during the entire time that everything was happening to the Snedekers, the upstairs neighbor who lived in the exact same building lived there without incident and had no issues.
I wondered that myself.
Is it because he didn't have the magic embalming room?
Yeah, maybe. Well, what about the son? Now, he was miraculously... I don't want to say he was cured, but he was, he fought the cancer and he beat it. And that's the reason supposedly why they moved back. Like they didn't need the house anymore because he was done his treatments.
Yeah. So he was done his treatments and they moved back to New York. Now he did actually die of cancer in 2000.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So 2012, he died of cancer at 38 years old.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate. But at least, I mean, he didn't die of the same cancer he was being treated for. I guess he got a second round or a second wing of something.
Wow.
So, thing that, that kind of caught my eye was that on all these articles about this story, all the sources that you can find, the Snedeker story was written about in a 1992 book called The Dark Place, A Story of a True Haunting by Ray Garten. And then Garten has since come out over and over and over again saying he was hired by Ed and Lorraine Warren to work with the Snedekers and write the true story of their house from hell. He interviewed all the family members and soon realized there was a problem. Quote, I found that the accounts of the individual's family didn't quite mesh. They couldn't keep their story straight. I went to Ed with this problem and he said, oh, they're crazy. He said, you've got some of the story. Just use whatever works and make the rest up. Just make it up and make it scary. End quote. Garten, who accepted the job expecting to have a real true story to base his book on, did as he was told. I used what I could, he said. I made the rest up and tried to make it as scary as I could. And this actually, he's said it a number of times now. Problem is that he didn't come out and say this until after Ed Warren was already dead. So to me, and actually it's happened a number of times to people that have come out like, I helped Ed Warren write his book on X, Y, and Z. Now that he's dead, let me tell you that he made it all up. Like, why? I don't know why you would do that. Like, why didn't you question it then, you know, when he's making all his money off of it or whatever? You know, why would you wait till the man's gone and can't defend himself or contest your story or whatever?
Yeah. Well, so it was kind of like the same story with the Lutz house and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But Garten, I mean, he's pretty adamant about his story and his quote about Ed Warren. It's always exactly the same, which to me screams a little more realistic than I made it up. Like his story, his quote that Ed Warren supposedly says, you know, they're crazy. You've got some of the story. Just use what works and make the rest up. Make it up and make it scary. Like that's word for word what he says in almost every interview that I've seen. So, I mean, that gives it a little bit of credence, I guess, in my head. I don't know what if it does for you or not.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like we discussed prior, you know, everything gets sensationalized along the way. So there could be a basis for a story, but it just isn't newsworthy until it's added to, you know. So,
I'm sure all these stories are exaggerated. I have no doubt about that. But whether or not they made it all up, that seemed a little much. So according to the current owner of the house, Susan Trotta Smith, who owned the house in 2013, that was the most recent version I could find. The true story is that the house is not haunted now and never was, according to her. We've lived in this house for 10 years. Our house is wonderful. This is all Hollywood foolishness. The stories are all ludicrous.
Well, you can take that in two different ways, too. Yes, her house is not haunted. Maybe the people in the house were haunted. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows?
However, they are basing their claim of the haunt was this mortician who supposedly practiced necrophilia.
True. So
it is, you know, so if you're going to make that claim, then it's harder to say that it's because of the people.
Right. Gotcha.
At least that's what I think. So one popular theory about this entire thing is that the medication used in Phillips' treatment could cause a side effect of him hallucinating. However, both his oncologist, other oncologists, and his mother have all said that this is impossible, that the medication does not cause hallucinations or mood swings or any of that other stuff that he was experiencing during the events. So could he have other mental health problems that were going on that were just exacerbated by everything that was happening in his life? Probably.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in cancer treatments for. I mean, we didn't know as much about cancers as we do today, too. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, and the effects thereof. So.
Exactly. So, I mean, take the whole story with the biggest grain of salt you can, you know, kind of make your own mind up about it. Obviously, what happened in the movie is not true. There was no bodies falling out of the walls and, you know, that kind of thing. You know.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Partially true, somewhat true, all true, no true?
I don't know. The more I look at the story, it was great for a TV movie, but, you know, the question is that the duplex thing, it's just like you said, nothing happened to the people that were in the other part of the house. So do I think something was happening? Yeah. Do I think it was a deep demonic force? No, I don't think so. So I just think that was a family that was going through a lot of crap and, you know, Yeah. So I have a hard time with it.
Seems to be a basis for a lot of these. It's always a family that's going through some kind of weird turmoil, weird struggle, and then all of a sudden, you know, and that's what some people say. Well, you know, they thrive on stress and strife, which is why they're attracted to these families. However, at the same time, people are saying, well, you know, it's also on the other hand, stress and turmoil sometimes makes for creative storytelling and exaggeration. And
if you don't have any hard evidence to back up your claims.
Well, the producers own it all, apparently.
Right. So maybe that's we should talk to them.
I just, yeah. So.
But, you know, if, I don't know, maybe a conversation with John to back up some things. But yes, no, I mean, you don't have the video or the, you know, digital voice recorder. You know, anything, tracks. Yeah. I don't know. So I would say no. I don't think it happened. It was a great made-for-TV thing, but I don't.
So, I mean, I think a family moved into a house that was a former mortuary. I think that probably some weird stuff happened, but the excessive exaggeration came when Hollywood started knocking on their door.
Yeah.
And the Warrens knocked on the door. That was when I was like, okay, let's amp this up.
Yeah. No, nope.
Although one thing on the other side of things, if you're going to believe that this all happened the way they say it is that Carmen Reed has never swayed her story.
Yeah.
Her story is always, so she's either really practiced at telling the story or she really believes it happened.
Right.
Which it might be true. It might be that she just really believes that it happened.
Yeah. So. It doesn't mean that it did happen, but yeah. Well, yeah, there's so many different ways to look at it. So,
either way, it is a interesting story all around. It is a very unique tale in and of itself with, you know, lots of elements that often don't get talked about. So hopefully you guys enjoyed our little stroll down this legend story.
Mm-hmm.
And make up your own mind. Let us know what you think. And we have to hand our mics over, so we're done for the night.
Wow.
I know. What happens when you have interesting content?
Painless. Man.
So.
Like a shot of COVID cure in the butt.
Well, okay. Whatever. On that note.
You know.
As always, I'm Rebecca.